Dr. Christian Smith is the William R. Kennan, Jr. Professor of Sociology and the Director of the Center for the Study of Religion and Society at the University of Notre Dame. He is the principal investigator of the National Study of Youth and Religion, the Science of Generosity Initiative, and the Parenting and the Intergenerational Transmission of Religious Faith Project. Dr. Smith received his BA in Sociology from Gordon College and an MA and PhD in Sociology from Harvard University. During his doctoral program, he spent a year studying Christian historical theology at Harvard Divinity School. Dr. Smith previously held faculty appointments at Gordon College and the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He is the author, co-author, or editor of numerous scholarly articles, book chapters, research reports, and books, some of which are used in classes here at BYU. Dr. Smith's scholarly interests focus on American religion, cultural sociology, adolescence, generosity, sociological theory, and philosophy of social science. He has received many awards for his contribution to the study of the sociology of religion. His 2005 book, Soul Searching, The Religious and Spiritual Lives of American Teenagers, co-authored with Melinda Lundquist Denton, won Christianity Today's 2005 Distinguished Book Award. He was awarded the Lilly Fellows Program Distinguished Book Award in 2011 for his book, co-authored with Patricia Snell, Souls in Transition, The Religious and Spiritual Lives of Emerging Adults. In 2012, the American Sociological Association section on altruism, morality, and social solidarity awarded Dr. Smith the Distinguished Career Award. That same year, he was honored with the Reverend Edmund P. Joyce CSC Award for Excellence in Undergraduate Teaching at the University of Notre Dame. Dr. Smith is a faculty fellow of the Kroc Institute for Peace Studies and the Helen Kellogg Institute for International Studies. We're delighted to have him on campus. Would you please join me in giving a warm welcome to Dr. Christian Smith.
Thank you very much. Good morning. First, I bring you greetings from Michael Wood, one of my very bright and promising sociology PhD graduate students at Notre Dame, who graduated BYU with a BS in sociology in 2012 and an MS in sociology in 2014. Please keep sending us more great students like him. Second, thank you so much for inviting me to give this lecture. I am honored to be here, and I hope that my thoughts this morning prove to be stimulating and useful. So I want today to address a specific concern related to the very big topic of the proper relation of science and religion. This is a hugely important issue, one that has generated a lot of controversy. The topic of science and religion is important because science and religion are both weighty matters in their own right, because science and religion sometimes address questions and make claims about the same subject matters, and because how we think about science and religion, how they ought to properly relate to one another, has big consequences for how we think about life and how we organize important social institutions such as schools. Furthermore, there's a lot of misguided and sloppy thinking about science and religion going on these days, including among some otherwise very smart people, and critiquing that can help to sharpen our own critical thinking skills. So I am a sociologist, but I'm also interested in certain philosophical questions. So my addressing the question of science religion here today is going to engage some philosophical issues, but in a way that will be framed by a sociological perspective. I'm going to say that arguments about science and religion not only concern clear and unclear thinking about ideas, which philosophy encourages us to consider, but also the question of the control of turf. By turf, I mean something like the areas of neighborhoods that gangs rule. Except that with science and religion, the turf in question is not controlled with threats and violence, as gangs do, but with institutionalized beliefs about authority and legitimacy that are struggled for and carefully protected by different groups of people with divergent, at least sometimes divergent, interests. The sociological question is, who has the right, the competence, the legitimate authority to make claims that stick? Claims that others should recognize as valid. Now, this is a sociological issue because it concerns the cultural construction of claims-making authority by different and sometimes rival social groups and institutions. I will complicate this turf metaphor in a bit below, but it's a good place to start. So, here's what I want to focus on this morning. I have observed that certain well-known science authors, often writing for popular audiences, seem to feel entitled to write with authority not only about science, but also to pronounce on metaphysics and religion. And I think that's often a problem. Here's what I mean. I read a lot of books about science. I really believe in the importance of science, and I want to learn from science all that I can. What I have noticed in reading some science books is that their authors abruptly slip from making scientific claims based on scientific methods and evidence to suddenly asserting metaphysical and theological claims, seemingly based on scientific authority, but which in fact have no proper scientific merit. Invariably, such claims contradict and dismiss religion. They're clearly made to undercut religious claims, authority, and plausibility. Here's one example. Last month, I was reading the globally best-selling book entitled Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind, published in 2015 by the Oxford educated Israeli scholar Yuval Noah Harari. In it, Harari pulls together massive amounts of scientific evidence to tell us about the long story of human biological and cultural evolution. So I was enjoying this book when on page 28, I suddenly found myself reading these words. Quote, "There are no gods in the universe outside of the common imagination of human beings. No things like gods exist outside the stories that people invent and tell one another. Religious myths are imagined. Fictions produced from collective imagination, not objective reality." So, I found these claims to be really jarring as a reader. I had just been reading about the human cognitive revolution, which good empirical evidence demonstrates occurred many tens of thousands of years ago. Next thing I know, I'm reading theological metaphysics. There are no gods in the universe. Really? How, I wondered, could or does Harari possibly know these things? From artifacts dug up in an archaeological excavation? Like, oh, look, there really are no gods in the universe. From fossils excavated in natural history museums? I think not. Said plainly, Harari is here engaging in a deceptive sleight of hand, an unacknowledged smuggling of theological metaphysics in through the back door of science, seemingly with the authority of science. I have no doubt that Harari would on principle defy religion setting two toes onto science's turf, but he obviously feels entitled to wander onto religion's turf to pour a tank of gasoline on it and set it on fire. Worse, Harari does not even seem to be aware of his own intellectual category shifting here. I will provide other examples like this in a moment, but first I want to make a crucial distinction. That is between, on the one hand, a scientist publicly offering a personal confession of his or her best evaluation of all of the available evidence and concluding that they cannot, as an individual, believe certain religious claims. And two, on the other hand, a scientist publicly suggesting or claiming with scientific authority that what science has learned itself shows that religious claims are false or almost certainly false. The first position is legitimate. Every scientist has the right to decide for his or herself whether they can or cannot believe certain religious claims, and the findings of science may play an appropriate role in that discernment, I believe. Furthermore, scientists, like everyone else, have the right to tell others about their personal beliefs. It's the second position, by contrast, that I take issue with. Scientists as public intellectuals have no legitimate intellectual grounds for making many of the dismissive metaphysical and theological claims that they make, supposedly on the basis of the findings of science itself. So just to make sure you do not think I'm cherry-picking an anomalous passage from an exceptional case, let me offer other examples of scientists interloping in this way onto the turf of metaphysics and theology. The biologist Edward O. Wilson claims in a book published last year that, quote, "The evidence is massive enough and clear enough to tell us this much. We were created not by a supernatural intelligence, but by chance and necessity. There is no evidence of a demonstrable destiny or purpose assigned to us. No second life vouchsafed us for the end of the present one. We are completely alone." Really? Empirical evidence tells us that? The University of Hawaii particle physicist Victor Stenger similarly writes, "Empirical data and the theories that successfully describe those data indicate that the universe did not come about as a purposeful creation. Based on our best current scientific knowledge, we conclude beyond a reasonable doubt that a God who is the highly intelligent, powerful supernatural creator of the physical universe does not exist." Paleoanthropologist Richard Leakey and science writer Roger Lewin claim that, quote, "The important message that comes to us from the fossil record is that any alleged God surely has no plans for Homo sapiens and could not even have predicted that such a species would ever arise." It's a very strange last claim, but this is what they write. I guess if you're God, you don't, well, whatever. For a final example, sufficient for present purposes, Marcelo Glazer, the Brazilian physicist and astronomer on faculty at Dartmouth College, writes, "There is no final truth to be discovered, no grand plan behind creation." Really? Science can tell us that? I don't think it can. The meta prefix of metaphysics makes a huge difference in distinguishing it from mere physics. So does the theo prefix in theology make it fundamentally different discipline of inquiry than other ologies like biology or cosmology. Yet scientists regularly venture such claims anyway. Consider this more recent statement by the physicist Steven Weinberg in his book, The First 3 Minutes. "It is almost irresistible," but he means, although it's false, "for humans to believe that we have some special relation to the universe." That's what we would like to believe. "The human life is not just a more or less farcical outcome of a chain of accidents reaching back to the first 3 minutes, but that we were somehow built from the beginning. It is very hard to realize that all of this is just a tiny part of an overwhelmingly hostile universe." The more the universe seems comprehensible through science, the more it also seems pointless. Weinberg here is trying to drive us from a physical description of the Big Bang, about which he has real expertise, to the conclusion that the universe is in fact pointless, which his expertise does not authorize him to make. What entitles him to move from science to metaphysics so effortlessly? It's unclear. And my simple point here is that it is, in fact, illegitimate intellectually. The metaphysics does not rationally follow from the science and never could. So on what grounds do such scientists seem to think they are entitled to pronounce like this on metaphysics and theology when they are not philosophers or theologians? Some, I suspect, do not even realize what they're doing. They appear simply to be oblivious to the relevant epistemological and discursive boundaries, and so do not realize that they have wandered onto somebody else's turf. The simple word for that, I'm afraid, is ignorance. Others, it seems, instead simply appear to believe that because they speak with the authority of science, then they are authorized to pronounce authoritatively on any topic that they please. The simple word for that is arrogance. It goes without saying that neither ignorance nor arrogance befit good science or those who represent science to the public. However, what I observe in such science writing is not simply the result of ignorance and arrogance, but instead also often follows from a particular epistemological assumption, epistemology having to do with what humans can know. Epistemological assumption that is powerful but rarely explicitly stated. This assumption is fallacious, and it sounds like this. If science cannot observe or discover something, then it cannot be real or true. Stated slightly differently, the only things that could be real or true are those that science can observe and validate. So, this is what we call vulgar imperialistic scientism. Not science, but the ideology of scientism. And running at even deeper levels, driving imperialistic scientism, are the pre-scientific presuppositions of naturalism, materialism, and empiricism. There's a lot of isms. I'm not going to take the time to unpack them, but just trust me, there's a lot running here. With all of these assumptions at work, science is turned by this ideology from legitimately being one fantastic way to know many things about ourselves in the world, instead into being, two, an imperialistic, exclusivist, totalizing source of any and all legitimate knowledge about everything. All comers must enter by the narrow gate of the scientific method if they hope to be welcomed into the kingdom of knowledge. This very scientism is clearly reflected in the passages by Wilson, Stenger, Leakey, and Lewin, quoted above, which try to make empirical data and massive and clear evidence and the fossil record, the sole adjudicator of God's existence and a purpose for the universe. To spell this out a bit further, let's return to Steven Weinberg's claim about the universe being pointless to see how this works. Weinberg has repeated his view about the pointlessness of the universe in many places. In one of them, he tellingly states that there is no point in the universe that we discover by the methods of science. We are faced with this unloving, impersonal universe, and we make in it any warmth and love for ourselves. Now, I do not disagree with Weinberg's first statement that there is no point in the universe that we discover by the methods of science. Of course, physics cannot discover a point to the universe any more than my kitchen thermometer could tell me what emotions you're feeling inside. Weinberg's statement about what science cannot discover is obvious. But the problem is that Weinberg concludes that because science cannot discover it, there actually, in fact, is no point to the universe. But that's silly. Simply because physics cannot discover the universe's possible point does not mean there is not one. All that Weinberg's conclusion really tells us is that he comes to his argument operating with the working presupposition of imperialistic scientism. That is, that if science cannot observe or discover something, it cannot be real or true. But if we reject that presupposition, as we should, then suddenly the universe might actually be found by other means to have a point, a meaning, a significance. Now, the bemusing irony of all of this is that the epistemological presupposition that supposedly authorizes only science to tell us what is real and true, and which produces such dramatic conclusions about the universe's pointlessness, is not itself a scientific statement, and never ever itself could be validated by empirical science. It is instead a point of philosophical presupposition, something not unlike a faith commitment. The logic of imperialistic scientism, then, turns out to be internally self-defeating. It depends, this is a little tricky, but follow this, it depends on a non-scientific position to take the position that only science authorizes us to take positions worth taking. And that's like me calling you on the telephone to tell you that I can't call you to talk because my telephone is not working. The very claim itself shows that the claim actually cannot be correct in a formal logical sense. A second irony here is that in the name of hard-nosed intellectual rigor, many such public intellectual scientists show themselves to be deeply confused about the basic nature of the religious ideas they're dismissing. For instance, the God of the Abrahamic traditions of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam is by nature radically transcendent, of an absolutely entirely different order of being than creation. And so, of course, is not subjectible to human empirical observation and experimentation. And by the way, I do realize that Mormon doctrine, relative to Jewish, Christian, and Islamic, would take a somewhat different approach to just how radically transcendent divinity is. But I'm not going to get into that. I'm comparing these scientific statements to the Judaism, Christianity, and Islam's view that God is radically transcendent. So an even half-educated believer in these traditions knows that God cannot be subject to human empirical observation and experimentation. So what such scientists are essentially saying to those religious people is this: I'm going to ignore your religion's actual claims, which I am sure are dumb, and instead substitute my own caricature of them. And then I'm going to dismiss my ill-informed caricature as failing to pass the test of my scientific standards, and then conclude that your religion is unbelievable. This we are supposed to take as a model of intellectual rigor. Now, to be very clear, I am not saying that no religious claims could be disproved by science. I'm not saying that all religious claims are somehow protected from scientific scrutiny simply by virtue of being religious. No, in fact, many religious claims that concern workings in this observable world are potentially liable to scientific invalidation. That is, if and when science has the tools and evidence to evaluate them. If, for example, a faith healer claimed to have cured someone's cancer, but medical tests showed the cancer remaining, the faith healer's claim would be invalidated. If science could figure out a way to send researchers back through a time machine to observe the first few days after Jesus' crucifixion and recorded on videotape the disciples stealing Jesus' dead body from the tomb and then claiming that Jesus rose from the dead by the power of God, that would put an end to all but the most demythologized liberal Christianity. Or if historians with new empirical evidence were somehow able to show beyond a reasonable doubt that the claims of Joseph Smith about the revelation of the golden plates in the woods of upstate New York were a hoax, that would sink Mormonism. I don't know what a hoax is, but I know what a hoax is. That would sink Mormonism. Usually, the passage of time and the lack of evidence and time machines make such scientific invalidations of religious claims impossible, for better or worse, even if in principle they are possible. But my main point here is a conceptual one. That is, some religious claims about reality are in principle subject to scientific evaluation. And some, in fact, those inherently beyond science's capacity to observe and analyze, simply are not. Now back to sociology. The fact that the kind of science writers I have quoted blithely interlope into metaphysics and theology without compunction, and sometimes it seems even without awareness that they are making such moves, and that they usually get away with it, reflects not only ignorance and arrogance in scientific ideology, but also the institutional fact that science has accumulated in the public sphere massive cultural authority, status, and prestige, much more than religion possesses. And however much modern people, including scientists, would like to believe that we operate purely rationally, we know that cultural status cognitively biases people's tendency to offer and accept beliefs generally, even erroneous beliefs. Stated differently, science is a dominant institution when it comes to knowledge claims. And one of the privileges of dominance is not having to learn and think as hard as one should when it comes to making claims beyond one's core competence. Peripheral voices, by comparison, have got to think very hard about their claims if they hope not to be sectarian, but instead to have their ideas taken seriously by the mainstream. But when one is already, by virtue of one's great institutional status and authority, taken very seriously, one can afford to get a bit intellectually sloppy with one's claims and still get away with them. This is a sociological observation. Once all of these institutional forces get moving in the same direction, the kind of public representatives of science I have quoted can take advantage of and reinforce the following kind of double standard. On the one hand, for religious believers, religion is a personal matter that must, as subjective opinion, be kept closeted in private life and certainly not allowed to say anything about science or education. On the other hand, for scientists, religion is a public matter subject to reductionistic dismissals on the authority of supposedly objective science. In other words, viewed as turf struggles between science and religion, the science gang has gained nearly complete control of the religion turf. Members of the religion gang may stay in their neighborhood as long as they keep off the streets. Then again, for representatives of the more aggressive new atheist persuasion like Richard Dawkins, the religion gang itself needs simply to surrender and disappear. But, to be clear, we actually need to observe that the situation here is more complicated than science and religion simply needing to respect each other's turf. That's actually a problematic metaphor. Because the metaphor of turf and gangs implies equal kinds of rivals fighting with the same sorts of weapons over the control of territory. In fact, that is exactly how the misguided religion writers I quoted above seem to view reality, which enables them to think that science can simply vanquish religion as a competitor. However, my most important point here is that science and religion, or metaphysics, are actually not equal kinds of rivals struggling with the same means over identical turf. Instead, they operate on different axes of thought according to distinctive epistemological sources and standards. So what is most fundamentally wrong about the science writers, who I quote above, in other words, is not that they disrespect rival gangs' turf, but that they make a basic category error in thinking in the first place that they can even judge such religious claims with scientific tools. Now, to be perfectly clear, I am not saying that science owns the facts and religion is stuck with something like only a crazy leap of faith. I'm not saying that. That simple dichotomy is false, too. Science itself is grounded on a set of presuppositions that are ultimately taken on faith or not about reality. And as Michael Polanyi has shown, scientific discovery is actually driven not by strict adherence to some method, but by deep, personal, pre-scientific commitments to human values like wonder, beauty, and truth. In other words, both science and religion are implicated in personal belief commitments of various kinds, and to the evaluation of the truth of those beliefs through the fact of lived experience, the facts of lived experience. These processes are not identical, but neither are they absolutely different. However, the difference that does matter here is something like this. Science seeks to understand the natural workings of matter, energy, life, the mind, and society that can be theoretically understood through direct and indirect empirical observation. Whereas most religions seek to understand and engage realities that either transcend creation, even if they interact with creation, such as a personal God, as in the Abrahamic faiths, or realities that the imminent material world actually obscures, such as the force of Brahman, as with Hinduism and Buddhism. In either case, even the most powerful of science's tools are constitutionally incompetent to penetrate and evaluate the latter. These may be humanly known, but if so, it must be through means other than scientific experiment, such as divine revelation or enlightenment, operating with reason and experience. One last thought about explaining scientists smuggling metaphysical theology in their science writings. I think that when we get down to it, a good part of what motivates many of these scientists to reject God, religion, and other non-naturalistic metaphysical views are not actually the findings of science, but instead personal, moral, and emotional objections. Now, I do not wish to psychoanalyze atheists, but years of discussion and observation have suggested to me that in many cases, if one scratches just below the surface of many allegedly scientific objections to religion, one finds not real scientific problems, but instead very often personal, moral, and emotional concerns. These may be understandable, they may be valid, and they may be compelling, but let us be clear that they are not science. Some science writers are more transparent than others. Consider, for example, Steven Weinberg again, who, in a 2003 interview, said this: "Maybe at the very bottom of it, I really don't like God. You know, it's silly to say I don't like God because I don't believe in God. But in the same sense that I don't like Iago or any of the other villains of literature, the God of traditional Judaism and Christianity and Islam seems to me a terrible character. He's a God who is obsessed with the degree of which people worship him and anxious to punish with the most awful torments those who don't worship him in the right way. The traditional God is a terrible character. I don't like him." Okay, I can understand that. My point is that that's not science. Okay. Or take Edward O. Wilson's moral objection to religion that faith is the one thing that makes otherwise good people do bad things. The great religions are tragically sources of ceaseless and unnecessary suffering. They are impediments to the grasp of reality needed to solve most social problems in the real world. Okay, that's a grotesque overstatement of something that has a kernel of truth. But again, it's not science. We can understand these personal, moral, and emotional objections to religion, even if they're grossly overstated, but let us be sure they're not good science and ought not to carry the weight of scientific authority, even if those who personally feel them are scientists professionally. Okay, coming to an end. Before I finish, let me clarify two points. First, nothing I have said here positively validates the truth claims of any religion. I am not making any apology for the truth of religion. That's not my point. That's not my purpose here. Second, it must also be said that not all popular science writers play at amateur metaphysics and atheology. Some writers, who are clearly anti-religious, are also more appropriately careful in the way they state their critiques. Now, such more careful writers may actually be sociologically more dangerous to religion, but intellectually, we should respect their more appropriate precision in presenting their views. Okay, here then is my bottom line. To all amateur scientific interlopers into metaphysics and theology, I say this: please stick to what you're good at, to science proper, and stop doing half-baked philosophy and theology without even being clear that this is what you're doing. I'm not telling this to you. I'm telling it to them. even though I'm looking at you. At the very least, learn enough to be able to distinguish in the first place between properly scientific, philosophical, and theological claims. Then, if you really want to make public claims about metaphysics and theology, first learn enough about the philosophy and religion you're engaging to speak accurately and intelligently about it so as not to embarrass yourself. And while you're at it, please think harder about your presuppositions of naturalism, materialism, and empiricism that drive you into narrow imperialistic scientism. Hopefully, when you do, you will realize that science, qua science, is constitutionally incapable of disproving the possible reality of what is most important in most religions, whether that be the God of Abraham, St. Paul, Muhammad, Zoroaster, or Joseph Smith, or karma, samsara, reincarnation, and nirvana. In the end, let's have good, rigorous arguments about science and religion, but let's have ones that are well-informed, fruitfully constructive where possible, and fair and honest when they must be critically destructive. Thank you.